from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. On today's show, we'll meet the Indianapolis Children's Choir's new artistic director, hear how professional storytellers can help your business succeed, consider the concept of home with some Spirit and Place Festival artists, and connect with voices from another dimension. Finally, we'll explore the Children's Museum with some actual children. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, we'll meet the guy who follows in the footsteps of the legendary Henry Leck, founder of the world-renowned Indianapolis Children's Choir. Speaking of children, we'll introduce Veronica and Max, who will take us on a visit to the world's largest children's museum. We'll talk about the intersection of dance, theater, and military service, and we'll revisit playwright Tom Horan. But first, a chance to learn how professional storytellers could help your business grow. What's the story of your business? In an increasingly noisy world, the ability to tell your core story with style can make the difference between success and failure. Storytelling Arts of Indiana's Executive Director Ellen Munns and storyteller Sally Perkins tell me about their upcoming workshop, The Story of Your Business and the Business of Your Story. So, Ellen, I'd like to start with you. Is this the sort of workshop you've offered before? You've done lots of different things, but I don't remember this.
I think this will be the third or fourth time.
Oh,
so we've
okay.
been doing it for a couple of years.
Okay.
It was a new venture. We wanted to reach into a new community of people, the business community, mm-hmm. and demonstrating how storytelling is effective. Oral storytelling, too, is effective in the business community.
And have you worked with Ellen Dunnigan in the past?
Yes.
Okay.
I have.
So, you know, anybody who explores social media, the world of social media, and that's everybody who's in any kind of business, including those of us in not-for-profit business, we see that S word all the time now. You have
yes.
to be happy about that. Both of you have to be happy about that story. You've always known the power of stories. But it seems as though the culture in general is coming back to that. What do you think? Why do you think that is? And I open that to either of you, Ellen, Sally.
Because it works.
It works.
Well, that's a good reason.
I think some of that has to do with this explosion of information in the age in which we live. And that explosion of information leads to a couple of things. One, an overwhelming amount of data and information that we have coming in. And so consequently, people are, A, hungry for story, but story is an important way of distinguishing different pieces of data and information that we have coming at us. So I think that's one of the reasons it's so very significant. The other thing is that with that flood of information comes lots of competing data and more competition among businesses and organizations. So, for example, when I talk with nonprofit organizations, I talk with them about the fact that they are competing with every other nonprofit organization for our dollars. We dutifully give our dollars to WFYI, but then at the same time, we're getting calls from all of the other nonprofits, as you well know.
And most consumers don't stop and say, I'm going to support that one because it's a not-for-profit. They support because it gives them a service or a good they want or
yes,
need.
Yes, right, exactly. And that's obviously true in the profit world as much as it is true in the nonprofit world. So when I talk to clients about the fact that when you're faced with that competition, really, and you have to make that decision, where am I going to give my dollars? At some point, there's limited resources, or at some point, we have to make decisions about where we're going to put our business, where we're going to put our dollars, and where we're going to offer them in nonprofit worlds. And stories become the distinguishing factor in our decision making. And there's a lot of research and theory to support that as well, that when we're faced with competing data, that is equally valuable to us, that ultimately it's the most compelling story that will win our guts and will win our souls.
And that's an important distinction, too, that it's not intellectual. Well, it may be a little intellectual,
yeah.
But there's something visceral is where it starts.
That's exactly right. Right. I often talk about this with a gentleman who's written a book called The New Articulate Executive. His name is Granville Toogood, and he talks about the difference between the conscious mind and the primal mind. Mm. And so the conscious mind might be what you're thinking about with the intellectual mind. It certainly is the part of our mind that processes data and information and reports and emails and schedules and all that sort of thing. But his argument is that if we want to move people to take action, we have to appeal to their primal mind, which truly is part of the more primal part of our brains, the reptilian part of our brains. And that's the part where we process stories. That's where our storytelling lives come from historically, is that most primal part of our brains. And I think that's the part that visceral element that has to be tapped into to really move people forward.
So I'm guessing that once somebody signs up to come to this two-part workshop, they're already kind of sold. But what kind of pushback have you gotten from people? Like, have you had somebody sign up who said, my boss said I should do this because I'm the marketing director or something like that?
I don't think we've had pushback.
No? Because by the time they get to you, they've thought
typically,
it
that's
and made
true,
a decision,
right? If they're yeah. signing up, it's because they have a sense of this could be valuable. I have, however, been in situations where people have given a little bit of pushback. Just recently, someone said, "Well, you know, there are those people who want the bottom line,
yeah,
right? Who do really don't want the story." Or I've had some skeptics who say the story is deceptive, and I think there's merit to the fact that the story isn't everything. It depends on what the story is, how the story is being told, whether we're telling a case story or whether we're telling the larger story of the organization. There are lots of different stories to be told. But there are those skeptics who want the data, who want sort of the bottom line kind of pitch. And so There's a place
Show
for that,
me how
certainly.
Looking through the storytelling lens can increase my sales by 20%. I'm sure there are people who have to think that way as part of their job.
Right.
So I don't want you to give too many tools the trade away because, of course, you'd like people to sign up for this. But if somebody comes in, say, who has a business that's 100 years old, and they're a little overwhelmed because there are so many stories from that century. Where do you point them to start?
That's a great question. Increasingly, we like to help people think about exactly that they've got different types of stories that they have in their organization. There's the origin story. Where did we come from? Which sometimes is a critical story that needs to be told because you're now 100 years in and your employees have no idea, right? Mm-hmm. And so the buy-in is different. The sensibility within the organization is different. And that origin story maybe needs to be told. Sometimes it's success stories. Sometimes it's stories of struggle. The time when the organization just about collapsed, but something happened. All of those may be different stories. So then the equation, essentially, and Ellen Dunnigan, I give her credit for this, becomes what's your purpose plus who is your audience? And that little addition equation sums up to what is the story that needs to be told. So depending on what our purpose is our purpose sales, is our purpose fundraising, is our purpose organizational motivation, is it internal cultural development? Those questions about purpose and to whom are we speaking? Are we speaking to an audience of skeptics? Are we speaking to an audience of employees within the corporation, outside the corporation? All those sorts of questions then add up to helping us make the determination what stories need to be told.
Storytelling Arts of Indiana's Executive Director Ellen Munns and Storyteller Sally Perkins.
Sally and business communication coach Ellen Dunnigan are presenting a two-part workshop called The Story of Your Business and the Business of Your Story on November 9th and November 16th. You can sign yourself up at storytellingarts.org. Still to come on today's show, Chef Michael Simons explains why he can't feel his feet most mornings. You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Moving into Walter and Millie's abandoned house seemed like a good idea at the time. That's what Emma tells herself. After all, they died 20 years ago. When Emma discovers Walter's tape recorder, she's drawn in by its strange collection of memories. The longer she stays in the house, the more consumed she becomes by the need to understand the couple's secrets. That's the setup for Tom Horan's latest world premiere work, and contributor Mark Allen spoke with Tom about writing, secrets, and spirits.
Let's start by reading the description of your new play, Static. 20 years after Walter and Millie have passed away, a young woman named Emma moves into their abandoned home. When she discovers Walter's tape recorder, she can't help but be drawn by its strange collection of memories. The longer she stays in the house, the more consumed she becomes by the need to understand the couple's secrets, the key to which it lies in a single missing tape, and Emma will stop at nothing to find it. That's spooky and mysterious and more than a little intriguing. So let's start by talking about the idea. Where did it come from?
I was on vacation in New Orleans and really wanted to write a ghost story. I'd gone some of those wonderful ghost tours they have in New Orleans and was inspired by that. And I was curious by how the things in our lives haunt us, and wanted to have create characters who were obsessed with different objects. So we see that bouncing back and forth in time, both with the woman in the present, seeing this collection years later, and with the people who created the collection to begin with.
Yeah. Do you believe in ghosts?
I remain agnostic.
So for the good things, like plays, you believe in the ghosts, then, I guess. Okay. Did you start with the idea and then create the characters to fit the story?
I would say that the idea and the characters came together pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Seeing an older couple who lived in the house and a younger couple was coming to figure out what exactly is going on there.
Okay. Walk us through the process a bit. Once you finish writing a draft, what happens from there?
Well, this one had a long process. It originally was inspired by an experimental piece I did while still living in Chicago, where we had the audience have headphones, and they walked from room to room hearing parts of the story. And then later, when I was in grad school, I wondered if that weird experiment could be turned into a play, and so it became actual characters. So I've been working on this play since about 2010, and it's seen various workshops with NNPN, which is the New Play Network, and with the Source Festival in D.C., and at UT Austin, where I do my grad work.
So that idea of walking through and hearing part of the story, was that like a game of telephone type thing, or were they hearing it just hearing pieces?
They were hearing pieces. Okay. It was almost like an audio tour in a museum. You know, the way you go from painting to painting in a museum, here it was you go room to room and hear parts of the story. And where it used to be sort of a narration, like a telling of the story, now it's an actual play where you're seeing scenes and those characters embodied.
So you've workshopped this play a couple of times. And mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about the evolution. Has it changed much since you started?
Yes. Huge sort of shifts, trying to understand who the characters were. I'm a sound designer as well as a playwright, so I was interested in how I could fuse both those interests together at the same time. So the sound is a major character in the play, and those tapes that you mentioned really help bridge the two times in the play and create a sense of atmosphere, and really are something that the characters and the actors are interacting with through the entire show.
You've been at the Phoenix for 4 years now.
Mm-hmm.
How's your role as playwright in residence changed in that time?
It's funny. When I came here, I was looking for a home, you know, a place that I could be as an artist, that I could develop, that I could learn to write work for the actors who are here, to engage the audiences that are here. And I've been received with open arms, and I've tried to pay that forward as best I could, give them a... be a part of this community as much as I could.
Okay. And along those lines, you've spent 4 years in Indianapolis, right?
That's right.
Tell us, what do you like about the theater scene here, and what would you change if you could?
I think it's a very intimate scene, a very nurturing theater scene that you see actors and designers who do work at some of the different theaters. I've had the opportunity to work at IRT at different times. And I do think what Brian Fonseca, the artistic director of the Phoenix, is doing is really should be praised on a national level. He does an extraordinary amount of shows in a given season. He's willing to take risks, not only in my work, but work of a bunch of new playwrights. My only wish that I would want to see different is that more people who didn't normally come to the theater would take a risk and walk inside our doors and see what we have to offer.
Contributor Mark Allen with Phoenix Theater's playwright-in-residence for the last 4 years, Tom Horan. The theater has produced Tom's Acid Dolphin Experiment and Leyenda in recent seasons, and this new play, Static, premieres on October 27th. Learn more at phoenixtheater.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, the Indianapolis Children's Choir's new artistic director has some really big shoes to fill. But first, it's time for Eat, Drink, Indy. Today, Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Cleveland's Iron Chef, Michael Simons of The Chew.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Cleveland. Okay, so you've been a big proponent of Cleveland. Do you still feel a part of the local food scene there?
Oh, absolutely. We opened our first restaurant there 20 years ago. It'll be 20 years in March. We just recently opened up our most recent one, Mabel's, about 6 months ago now. And I'm in Cleveland all the time. So, you know, I essentially we film The Chew Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. The remainder of the week, typically, I'm in Cleveland. So the great thing about what's happened in the food scene there now that for me is very rewarding is not only are our restaurants doing well, thank God, but a lot of people that have worked for us have opened their own restaurants, and they've been very successful.
How often do you manage to get to the restaurants like the one in Indianapolis?
I tried to get out to every location minimally once a month. Sometimes it stretches to 6 weeks or so, but we're pretty good about it. And the corporate chef of our B-Spots has worked for Liz, Doug, and I for 22 years.
Have you checked out very many places in Indianapolis? You know, one of our restaurants, Milktooth, was just on.
I was going to say Milktooth. I was saying this to someone earlier. Milktooth, to me, is not only one of the most special restaurants here. I think it's a completely special and unique restaurant, regardless of where it is.
It just hit the Condé Nast list of some of the best restaurants in the world, which was awesome.
Unbelievable. And last year, he won Food & Wine Best New Chef, which I won in the 90s. That's a great award that kind of propels other things like Condé Nast Day. And hopefully, you know, he'll get his due with James Beard soon. And very special restaurant.
Well, I was going to ask you, how much do things like that help? Was it a big boost to you along the way, the James Beard Awards and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think times have changed a little bit with media. You know, I won Food & Wine Best New Chef in 98. You know, back then there were pretty much only three publications that wrote about food, and there was no, you know, Food Network. I started on Food Network in 98, too. It had just started in 96. There was no blogs or social media or all those other things that happen now. So I think they had slightly more impact maybe then than they do now. I still think the James Beard Award has even more of an impact on your community than it even does on your restaurant. I think the food scene in Indy is very dynamic and very exciting.
So, you know, the James Beard, there's a James Beard conference next week talking about issues that chefs are involved in. What are some of the issues that you see chefs involved in now, which probably has changed over the past 20 years?
Yeah, I think they've changed, but I think they sadly still remain the same. You know, I think hunger is still a giant issue. We have the country that has the most waste and the most hunger, go figure. Children's lunches, I still think, although it's has moved in the right direction, that we get healthier school lunches for our kids, you know, and I just think that hopefully that the government rules for how food is produced become a little bit more strict here than they are in the rest of the world. Like, how could bromated flour be illegal almost worldwide, but 99% of the bread produced in our country has bromine in it? How could GMOs be illegal mostly worldwide, but here most of our food has GMOs in it? You know, I think some of those laws got to get a little bit more strict. Not necessarily that that's going to make food more delicious, but it's going to make it much safer for our kids and our kids' kids and so forth.
Any advice for young people who are interested in food today who might not have been interested in it years ago?
Absolutely. You know, I would say continue to watch cooking shows. They're fun, but don't think that being a chef is anything like a cooking show. I'm almost 50 years old. I need 2 knee replacements. My hips are shot, and I can't feel my feet most mornings. The neat thing is now there's a lot of different culinary paths that are available that never were available when I was a kid. You know, now you could get into food styling, food production, food TV production, things of that nature. You don't just have to go to culinary school to become a chef. I tell people when they say, I want to be a chef, I said, are you ready for the first 20 years of your career? Are you ready to never go to a wedding, never spend a holiday with your family, and work every night till 1 a.m? And if they say yes, then, you know, we're there. You know, we're moving in the right direction. But I just think that people should know that before they dive into it. When I went to culinary school, there were 2 culinary schools. Now there's, I don't know how many, but significantly more than 2.
Hear Jolene's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. The Indianapolis Children's Choir's new season marks a new era for the choir and introduces artistic director Joshua Petty as he takes over for longtime artistic director and founder Henry Leck. The Cabaret's Shannon Forsell talked with Josh about what it's like following a legend, what changes we might see in the world-renowned organization, and why kids get lots more than musical skills from participating in one of the ensembles.
Josh, this is your inaugural season as the artistic director of the Indianapolis Children's Choir, but you are by no means a stranger to the choir, and in fact are really kind of a bit of a protege to Henry Leck, the founder of the Children's Choir.
Yeah.
And so tell us a little bit about your history with the Children's Choir.
So my history in a nutshell is I went to Butler University, did my undergrad and master's there, but when I went to Butler, met Henry Leck. He was my choir director there. Had no idea what a children's choir was, but I knew I wanted to be a director. I wanted to be a conductor. So I went into Henry's office and said, I want to be a conductor. I want you to teach me conducting. I don't want to wait to my junior, senior year. And after getting approval from, you know, the higher ups at Butler, he said, well, part of your training is going to be to come to the Indianapolis Children's Choir. Thought it was a room of, like, you know, third and fourth graders, 40 of them singing music. You know, I walked into a world that I was blown away by. I went into CTS, into their choir room. There were 80 some kids there, mainly middle schoolers, and they were singing music that was just incredible. I mean, music that I had not even sung yet. And I was in college. And so that was the beginning of it. And that was 16 years ago.
Oh, my gosh. And here we are today.
Yes.
And now you're the man. So, and the children's choir is one of the largest children's choirs in the world. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
That's an amazing thing. And certainly there's a big shadow that follows Henry Leck. And that's kind of a big responsibility
yes.
for you.
Yeah.
So what kind of changes, you know, it also presents an opportunity. An
right.
opportunity for kind of a fresh look at things
right.
and some fresh approaches. So what are you excited to bring to the table as Josh Petty for this year's children's choir and coming up?
The tagline this year is a new era based on a historic past. And it's honoring all of that past 30 years, all of the great things that the children's choir has been, being a part of the community and the great music education. But there are things that are more Josh Petty-esque. you know, I look at the concerts. And the typical choir concert is dying. That's not a model that the audiences are going to hear anymore. And so we want to tell stories. We want to show a storyline and take people on an adventure and transport them somewhere. You know, if they go to the cabaret, they're going to hear all of these personal stories, and all of a sudden they're going to be drawn into the artist. And in a choral concert, that's a little harder to do, but we're going to do that. And one of the other things that I don't think many people expect is to come and hear children singing amazing music. And they think, oh, it's a children's choir. Oh, what can they do? They can do incredible things. And, you know, we also talked about not only doing classical music, but doing popular music and really expanding the genre of what the children's choir is doing.
That's really exciting.
Yeah.
Now, is it? Can you still enroll to be in the children's choir? Is enrollment still open?
Of course. Enrollment is still open. We would love to have more singers come and join us. If they want to be part of a community, be part of people who love to sing, and meet new people from around the Indianapolis area, this is a great place to
and
do that.
Why the children's choir? You know, a lot of folks are going to say, hey, my child's in choir already. Why should I pay to be in the children's choir?
It's taking it to that next level in anything you do. You know, you might be in basketball at school or whatever, but then you join the rec club and your experience helps create you know, a better, well-rounded person. And so the children's choir is really taking it to that next level of professionalism, more stages. I mean, how many choirs can put a student on Clues Hall, Hilbert Theater, mm-hmm. take them to Germany and put them over on stages in Europe? All of those things can be done through the children's choir. And when you take the best of the best out of the schools and you put them together in a room, incredible things happen.
Mm-hmm. I'm also amazed at the things that you teach your folks that are things I had wished I could learn, you know, as a music student.
Yes.
You know, sight reading, sight singing, how to read music. Oftentimes
yeah.
those things aren't kind of taught in the
exactly.
regular school setting these days, especially as music and the arts kind of filter out a little bit. So that's very, very exciting.
Yeah.
So if folks want to say, hey, I want to enroll my child in the children's choir, where would they find out more information?
Well, they can either call our office, 317-940-9640, or go to our website, which is www.icchoir.org.
Well, this sounds very exciting, Josh, and it sounds like it's going to be an exciting season. And for more information, check that information out, and best of luck to you, and thanks for being
thanks,
on
Shannon.
The Art of the Matter.
The Cabaret, Shannon Forsell with Indianapolis Children's Choir Artistic Director Joshua Petty. For more information about ICC's 2016-2017 season, which begins this week, or to enroll your young singer, visit icchoir.org. Programs that inspire a love of the arts in children can be found all over central Indiana, and WFYI's Jill Sheridan and her two young children, Veronica and Max, are going to investigate these resources for The Art of the Matter. This month, they visited the Children's Museum's 53rd annual Haunted House and experienced the art of Halloween.
As you make your way down the hall toward the Haunted House, the walls are lined with artwork from area school children. Hundreds participated in a contest paired with this year's theme for the annual event at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, The Cursed Castle.
A forced perspective.
Over the moat and through the drawbridge, this year's haunted experience immediately starts telling the story of how the castle became doomed, explains Look Chair Rebecca Aurora.
The curse is now here. And these big murals on both sides are made of muslin. They are painted to show the story of like the king going out into battle, and then he slays the big dragon and captures the baby dragon. Years pass, and the jester decides one day it's going to be fun to let the dragon out as a joke, and then we have the cursed castle. So this is sort of the story background as we go through. We have a contract artist. His name is Eric Wallentine, and he did these murals.
Indie artist Wallentine yes. helped with a number of finely crafted details throughout the castle. The lights are on for our walkthrough, so Veronica and Max can see the artistic detail that's gone into every corner. There's also a dragon tail hidden in every room, engaging children in the task of looking.
Cool decor, but then when we turn the lights off, it's sort of we have our haunters who hide in these, like, spaces.
For older children, the Cursed Castle offers a lights-off option that provides a chance for children to engage in the theatrical experience of a haunted house. Guild members who are in charge of erecting, decorating, and crafting the haunted house every year spend nearly 1,000 hours working on the house.
There's a giant bug.
Molly Kitchell is another of the Look Chairs in charge of building Haunted House. Kitchell says they've been planning this year's event for over a year.
So, I mean, the theme is nailed down a year in advance, and then there's basically four of us, that the Look Chairs and the Head Witches, that throughout the year are involved in kind of crafting the big picture idea of what it is going to look like and how we're going to present the story. And then our actual committee really doesn't start working until August.
Children of guild members have also helped to craft decorations that adorn every corner.
We had kids that helped us paint our shields that are in the arches throughout, the stained glass windows we had children paint for us, the stoning out and the sponge, like the the aging technique that we use to wash the bricks, the flags hanging above.
And the artwork doesn't have to be perfect. That's part of the fun when engaging children in the art of Halloween. The Children's Museum's Kimberly Harms says it's all about urging children to use their imagination.
So, for example, if someone asks a child to draw an apple, don't make them draw a red apple. Let them use their imagination. And when you go through the haunted house, you see that a bat doesn't have to be perfect with all its wings a certain way. It can have a broken wing, and that might tell a story of its own. Or you can have other objects, just as she's showing me her beautiful artwork that she's making right now. So they're inspired already just by taking a walk through the haunted house.
The art of storytelling inspires as the house unfolds. The piece de resistance is a 10-foot-tall dragon named Bernadette looming over the kids.
She looks like a big old dragon.
Valentine crafted her head from a large piece of foam. The rest of her body is paper mache.
Green.
Max gives his impression of the fire-breathing beast.
Big old dragon.
Does she look pretty or scary?
Pretty and scary.
The Cursed Castle runs through October 30th.
WFYI's Jill Sheridan and her children, Veronica and Max. This year, our children's museum, the world's largest, is staging its 53rd annual haunted house, The Cursed Castle. This event is put on by the Children's Museum Guild, and it runs through October 30th. You can learn about tickets, lights-on hours for younger children, and the Black Hat Dash Fun Run and Walk for Families at childrensmuseum.org. Hey, Jill, I kind of wish I had a Veronica and Max in my life so I could go to the haunted house.
It's always fun to go to the haunted house, no matter how old you are.
And I know.
You know something I learned about the haunted house?
What's that?
The day after it closes, the guild gets together and starts work on the next year's.
No way.
Yeah. They
That's
decide
amazing.
What the name's going to be and what the theme's going to be. They love creating it as much as kids like Veronica and Max
oh,
like to go
I
see.
Oh, I love that.
Another reason to go see it.
Here's a funny little tidbit. I used to work at the Children's Museum, and when you work at the Children's Museum and you're female, you must own a sweater or a sweatshirt with a Halloween theme. It's like a thing. It's not in the employee manual. Don't worry if you're out there thinking about working for the Children's Museum. But it's just a thing. You just do it because you see all the Children's Museum Guild folks around with their special jack-o'-lantern sweaters or whatever. It's such camaraderie and fun. And my neighbor Opal, who is 5, went with her pop. And their favorite thing was the dragon. They said it was the most beautiful dragon they have ever seen.
Yeah, just from the visual aspect as an adult, just visually seeing it, it's quite an undertaking that they produce over there.
So, dear listeners, please do not write us and offer to loan us your children. Jill and I will just go as grown-ups and we'll pretend our children are lost somewhere in the Cursed Castle.
Yeah.
But we do have some other things you can do both with and without your children on our calendar that we call.
What do we do?
What do you have?
Well, this is something else that is also for the children but and for the adults, too. You have one more opportunity today, October the 23rd, at 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock. It's the No Exit Performances Bad Wolf. And
ooh.
This is their take on the Boy Who Cried Wolf. And they perform it outdoors at Fort Harrison State Park. And it's created for families, so it's a take on that fun fairy tale. And you do move around the park because No Exit's all about being interactive.
Right.
So you could probably do the Cursed Castle, and if you survive that, then you could go see Bad Wolf.
I love it. Hey, I'm not sure that you necessarily want to take your kids to my next item, but the IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute is presenting the premiere of a new audio-visual sci-fi experience called Death of the Mechanical Man. It's developed by Big Robot in collaboration with Brian McCutcheon, and it brings together silent film, acoustic instruments, and computer interactivity to create what they call a multidimensional performance of sound and space. And if that isn't cool enough, where are they showing it for the first time? In the catacombs under the Indianapolis City Market. If you've never been down there, people just have this
fascination with it. There's a dirt floor, limestone columns and brick barrel arches, and there was a terrible winter about a century ago, and the mayor of Indianapolis opened the catacombs under the city market for people who didn't have any place to go to stay. So there, it has kind of a storied past. When is this crazy multimedia film thing? It's this coming Tuesday, the 25th at 7 o'clock. It's free. You need to go online and score yourself some tickets. Just Google Death of the Mechanical Man, Indianapolis, and you'll get all the info you need. Now for something that really isn't all that spooky. It is the first concert of the season, the second concert of the season for the Hendrix Symphony Orchestra. They're presenting Bach to Handel, a concert of Baroque music at Avon Middle School North Auditorium. They're doing the Brandenburg Concerto No. 2 and many more major Baroque composers besides Bach, including Handel, Purcell, and Scarlatti. It's the Hendrix Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. They're performing this Friday night at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 3.
And then coming up on October 29th at the Indiana History Center, they're turning the place into a mad scientist laboratory. A laboratory, exactly. zombie-infected brains... Glow-in-the-dark slime. It's the science spectacular. Doesn't that sound like a lot of fun? It takes place on the 29th from noon to 4, and you can stop by and whip up your own brew and goo and potion as part of a step back in time, sort of, kind of.
Mad scientists everywhere you look. Well, don't forget, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide. The Arts Council of Indianapolis is Indie Arts Guide. Or tune in next week because, you know, Halloween won't be over by next week. We'll have more spooky things on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Indianapolis is home to an unusual citywide collaboration called the Spirit and Place Festival. It's at the intersection of the arts, spirituality, and humanities, and this year's festival uses the theme of home as its organizing principle. From November 4th through the 13th, more than 100 partner organizations will offer performances, exhibits, documentaries, and conversations. I recently spoke with Lev Rothenberg of the JCC and Paul Hansen of Dance Kaleidoscope. Along with the Indiana Writers Center, the Indiana Historical Society, and Jewish Family Services, they're creating a performance called Writing Home, the Stories of American Veterans in Words, Dance, and Theater. Have the JCC and DK collaborated before for Spirit and Place?
Oh, yes. This is our third year.
I thought I remembered that. And you're bringing in the Writers Center as well?
Well, actually, the Writers Center was part of the collaboration, has been for the last 3 years also, as has Jewish Family Services. This year, we're fortunate to also be bringing in the Indiana Historical Society.
Right. So this happy family keeps growing.
Yes.
How did the idea for this year's collaboration come up?
Well, it's actually a pretty cool thing. You know, we've worked with a number of different groups, and we really were interested in working with military, with veterans. And Spirit and Place gave the theme of home, and it just seemed natural to work with veterans and their impression of home while they're away doing their thing.
Yeah, actually, you bring that up, and DK has done a number of kind of pioneering projects talking to people who are incarcerated about what their experience of life is and interpreting it in motion, in dance, in movement.
Oh, yeah. You know, dance is really spectacular in that it goes beyond what any words could possibly say. And so I think that these programs are therapeutic to the participants, absolutely, to these veterans for this project, to the dancers who really love doing these projects because they're experiencing the veterans' stories and bringing them to life or working from the emotion that is stirred from their story. It's also really therapeutic and marvelous for the audience. You know, the first time that I experienced DK participating in Spirit in Place was with a group of people who were visually impaired.
Mm-hmm.
And I was transcribing for audio transcribing for people who were visually impaired, the performance. And so I had my own challenges, and I wondered how this was going to go. But what's really cool, and it's happening with this program as well, is that the dancers will be on stage perhaps with these veterans, at least with these veterans' stories. And what it does for the audience is always surprising, because there is so much truth, so much honesty, so much authenticity, and you just feel it. There's this gorgeous energy in the air that every artist aspires for.
And dance can express emotions that maybe cannot be put into words, and maybe in particular I'm thinking of veterans who have served abroad, a world-changing, life-changing experience, that is, and it might be hard to put that into words, and that's where motion can help.
Well, we found it's an interesting intersection, because Indiana Writers Center does get people to put into words. So the audience experiences the words and the dance, which I think adds a great deal. And you know what Paul mentioned as far as what the audience takes of it, last year audience members told me that they found it was a truly spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly expect even more of that, you know, this year.
And I should mention, we're having this conversation as you're still getting this production outlined and up on its feet, literally and figuratively. So what is that process like? So how did you select veterans with whom to partner, and how is the Writers Center putting the words in this?
Well, we reached out to a number of groups. The Writers Center had a program especially for women's veterans. And then we reached out to homeless veterans, various different veterans groups.
Mm-hmm.
Barb Shoup of the Writers Center, along with some others, would meet with them and kind of help them with their writing. And then the next step that we do is we bring those writings to Dance Kaleidoscope, and the dancers decide which ones they would like to interpret.
And is there music?
Sure. You know, the veterans and the dancers work together. And that process that Lev just mentioned of the dancers choosing, it's pretty cool, because it's which story resonates with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which do they feel is going to inspire them to create? So what happens is there are conversations between the veteran and the dancer, if able, and then they create the piece. Sometimes the veteran chooses to participate in the dance. That's happened in the past. Sometimes their words will be spoken, read before a dance, and sometimes the veterans themselves will read the story, and then there's dance. It's pretty special.
It's lovely that you have the latitude to do what is most appropriate, comfortable, feels like the right mix.
Right, which means it's going to be a really varied program. You know, sometimes the stories are humorous. You know, some of us have to use humor as therapy to deal with tough situations. I'm one of those guys.
We have no idea what you're talking about. No, not a single one of our listeners does that. I'm just sure of it.
Absolutely. You know, but some of the stories are really raw and can be difficult to listen to, but are just beautiful. And those moments when you realize that you're hearing somebody's toughest, most truthful reality done almost in a poetic way, you know, through the Writers Center, how they've helped them turn their emotions and memories into this beautiful story, and then that it's artistically interpreted is just stellar.
And we found that the writers who have written for this project go from World War II to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Oh, wow.
But Indiana Writers, Indianapolis, Indiana Historical Society, actually is bringing letters that go all the way back to the Spanish-American War.
Wow.
So
what a continuum.
Absolutely.
An
and we will have a
display
of those letters.
But a continuum.
Letters. Well, in some cases, it's very happy.
Yeah.
I mean, the letters that people have written about coming home, about the food that they're looking forward to eating, is very happy. Yes, it's unhappy that we have so many wars, of course.
Yeah. I love that the first performance is on Veterans Day. How appropriate. And at a venue that's only, how old is Theater at the Fort? 2 years now? Not terribly old. But then, where else will people get to see this?
Well, it will also be at the JCC as part of our AnCats Festival of Books and Arts.
Fantastic. As far as you know so far, can children come to this? Or do you think there might be some things that are a little too intense?
I would certainly expect, I mean, you would not want to bring a 5 or a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
I would think a 12-year-old, for example, would probably find it very meaningful. The music, the dance is something that will be, you know, certainly keep everyone's attention. Mm-hmm. So sure.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want you to give away any secrets, but you guys are having such a great partnership. You're going to do this again next year, I'll bet.
We're already talking about it.
JCC Indy's Lev Rothenberg and Dance Kaleidoscope's Paul Hansen. With the Indiana Writers' Center, the Indiana Historical Society, and Jewish Family Services, they're creating a performance called Writing Home, the Stories of American Veterans in Words, Dance, and Theater. It's just one of dozens of events and performances that are part of this year's Spirit and Place Festival, November 4th through the 13th. You can listen for essays about this year's theme, Home, by community leaders, here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. The Indiana Writers' Center has just published a collection called Finding the Words, Stories and Poems of Women Veterans. Here's a poem by Shanna Reese from the new book.
Boots on ground. My tan boots are blackened from wear. Afghanistan is caked into the boot strings. Iraq is ground dark into the toes and heel. And my homeland is just a trace on the soul.
WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer read Boots on Ground, a poem by Shanna Reese. It's from the Indiana Writer Center's brand new collection, Finding the Words, Stories and Poems of Women Veterans. Learn more at indianawriters.org or at the Spirit and Place Festival event, Writing Home, the Stories of American Veterans in Words, Dance, and Theater. Next, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long visits Josie Hunkler of Rabble Coffee in Woodruff Place.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto, and I'm broadcasting live today from Rabble Coffee on East 10th Street. I'm joined by Rabble Coffee owner Josie Hunkler, who's picked out 5 songs to share with us today. And Josie, the reason why I asked you to do this is because every time I come into Rabble Coffee, you're playing really extraordinary music. You work here all day, and you're curating the music for the customers, so you're essentially DJing all day here at Rabble Coffee. What's your philosophy behind the music you play for your customers?
It's a lot of fun to like try to figure out what the people want to listen to collectively and be like, well, this person is dressed like this, and this person is dressed like that, and what's a band that they could probably agree on? Just judging on our really brief interaction and like the way they're dressed or whatever. I know that makes me sound creepy because it makes it sound like I'm watching you or something, but I'm not. It's really second nature by now because I've been doing it for years, long before Rabble opened.
Josie, what's your first song?
My first song is The Hop by Radio Citizen featuring Baika. I love the drums. I love that the song doesn't even necessarily develop. It's just more of a feeling. It's just a groove. Calling in my lacking in the twist to cap, and in the days back, climbing up the coast like that. Tangerine on ice in the back seat. Just do a roll it top down, but it's a fly on the street.
What's your second song for us, Josie?
It's a guilty pleasure, I guess, as people say. I like this song by Foreigner, Cold as Ice.
You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love.
I had a record of it. My dad had a very large and weird record collection when I was growing up. I found this Foreigner album in there, and I am not a major Foreigner fan, but this song I've really liked for a long time. Third song would be Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Wanna Have Fun, because it's incredible. Because it was way ahead of its time, I think, and the synth is incredible. And I just said incredible twice, and I'm Donald Trump.
You're gonna live your life right. Oh, Mama, dear, we're not the fortune.
What's your fourth song for us, Josie?
This is actually a cover by The Slits. It's I Heard It Through the Grapevine, which is originally by Marvin Gaye. And the Slits were a late 70s British punk rock band, all girls. And they toured around a lot with The Clash. They were kind of like the female version of The Clash, which I grew up really loving The Clash. So when I found out there was a girl version, specifically during my, like, I only listened to girl phase, I was just in love immediately.
And Josie, your fifth and final song.
It's Mind Your Own Business by Delta 5. Girls are screaming, they're going crazy, they're layering their vocals and singing. It's kind of a cliche a bit, but I really like it anyway.
Can I have a taste of your ice cream? Can I lick the crumbs from your table? Can I interfere in your crisis? No!
Once again, I'm here broadcasting live at the wonderful Rabble Coffee on East 10th Street. Josie, what's the best way for people to keep up with Rabble Coffee online?
Rabblecoffee.com. Most of our events are posted and up to date on our Facebook. Just search for Rabble Coffee.
Kyle Long with Rabble Coffee's Josie Hungler. Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for spending some time with The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today's contributors included Mark Allen, Shannon Forsell, and Jill Sheridan. You can hear our program twice each week on 90.1 FM, Saturday mornings at 7 and Thursday evenings at 8. If you hear something you like and want to share, go to WFYI.org for our podcast. Tune in next week when you'll meet a son who inspired his mother to become an artist, a longtime ISO bassist who's inspiring new generations, and we'll check out this year's Tonic Ball. We'll also learn about the Idlejorg's new exhibition called The Titan of the West and meet Viking-inspired Andy D. And, of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.